This is David Rovix, and you are tuned to 3CR, 855 AM, Melbourne, Australia. Step 3 is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Show. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. Andy and I would like to pay our respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, from whose land we are broadcasting at 3CR, and the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, where we can be heard at Radio Skid Row. This show was first broadcast in 2021. Tonight we're going to talk about two films, Once You Know and Beyond Zero. What happens once you know about climate change? We will hear about people who have had a spear in the chest moment and have been reborn. We'll talk to Emmanuel Capelin in France about collapsology, about Joanna Macy, and how we need to evolve as we face the end of our industrial civilization and a new social contract is born. And then I'll speak to Nathan Havey in USA, whose film Beyond Zero is about Ray Anderson and his carpet company called Interface. After Ray's spear in the chest moment about climate, his company was reborn. So, appropriately for Easter, tonight's show is all about regeneration. Once You Know is the name of Emmanuel Capelin's film at the Transition Film Festival. He is speaking to me from France. What I loved in this film is Emmanuel taking us to meet people like Dr. Salim ul Haq in Bangladesh and Richard Heinberg in the USA. These are people I've interviewed, and just to hear how they're carrying on their climate work lifted my heart. Emmanuel finds in them the same courage and energy that I noticed, and he asks them how you can live once you know. So welcome, Emmanuel, to the Climate Action Show. Tell us what it's like where you are today.
Well, it's early dawn. There's a beautiful orange sunrise, and everything is very, very green and very moist because we've had a series of very, very heavy rains, an increase of over 40% in precipitation with floods everywhere. I'm in the Dordogne Valley here in the western France.
We've all seen films about the end of the world, you know, usually very sensational and playing up the greed and cruelty of all the main actors. I hate those films. They're so unreal. And yet they dominate a lot of people's fantasy world about what's happening. Why did you make your film? It's a documentary. It's completely different.
We have a term, a new word that's come out in France called collapsology. Collapsology is the study of collapse on a rational basis, but also taking into account all of the emotional aspects that this, the possibility of the ending of our industrial civilization brings out. And I thought that it was really important that we have a national and international conversation on that very new topic, which is slowly spreading to other countries. In England, now they have a movement around what's called radical adaptation or deep adaptation, which is also on the hypothesis that we are indeed on a path towards collapse. And how do you deal with that personally? And how do you deal with that collectively? And I think if you want to bring in a more subjective aspect to the topic of collapsology, then you have to start with the question of how does collapse explode in my own mind? Because we say that collapse is like a grenade. It's a grenade word. You hear it and it explodes in your mind in different ways for everyone. We all have our own phobias and fears and hopes as well as to what's going to save us against which dangers. And so in the beginning of the film, the opening sequence, I try to be very honest and to show how does that grenade explode in my mind, and to show the kinds of images. So we have historical archives that come out of the past. They're also related to my own history. What do you hear? What do you see when you hear collapse? And that really was the basis for the whole quest. Once you know you can never be the same, since you are changed, how do you want to be changed? Towards something, you know, more positive and transformative, or towards depression and, you know, just feeling that you're stuck? And that's what brings me towards these other people, like Salim, like Richard, like you, that you mentioned, like Susie, Suzanne Moser, who's a German geographer, or towards Jean-Marc Jancovici, who's a French energy expert. What they all have in common is that they have been facing that word or similar ideas of the possibility of an end to our great human experiment for 30, 20, 30, maybe some 40 years. And what kinds of coping mechanisms do you put in place, both personally and collectively? And what I love about them all is that they have these two sides that are up to their work that's very developed, both personal and collective.
Yeah. Well, what impressed you about one of them? Just tell me one of them. You loved Susie. There's a lot of filming of her smiling, you know, and you just obviously loved following her and listening to what she had to say. What was the, you know, the seriousness that you discovered in some of those people?
I lived in Berkeley for a few years, and there is an American eco-psychologist thinking and writing and working on these issues since the 70s, so for nearly 50 years. Her name is Joanna Macy, and she's quite famous as an eco-psychologist and has worked on the ideas of the deep ecology movement, which says that the environment, the nature, has a right to of its own to exist, and not just for its utilitarian value to humans. So it's taking a biocentric view of what the world instead of an anthropocentric or human-centered view of the world. And I really wanted her to be part of the film, and I went to see her, and she was probably like 90 years old, and she just finished another film. And she said, "Oh, Emmanuel, I'm an old lady. I'm old and tired, and, you know, I'm done, you know, but you should go and see Susie. Susie is just wonderful. She's beautiful, and she's such incredible energy, and you're going to love her." And the next day, that was in Berkeley. And so I drove down to Santa Cruz, where she lives. I felt such a connection, and I identified so much to what she was saying, that I decided that for sure she was going to be one of the characters or one of the protagonists of the film. And then I followed her over several years. Every time we had an opportunity, since I wouldn't fly around, we would take advantage of her having to go to different congress or so. As a geographer, she works on vulnerability and adaptation to climate change in general and to sea level rise in particular. So she works with coastal communities of the East and West Coast in the United States. And so she has been working with the whole question of how much do you fight to stay your ground, and when do you decide to leave? And these questions of the grief that goes with losing your home, your sense of identity, your community, has been something she's worked for many years. In parallel to that, she works with practitioners, people who are urbanists, who are urban planners, to help them plan for the long future. She has seen that there was such a disconnect between the kinds of emotions that all of these conversations at the community level were bringing out, but the lack of emotion in her more professional work. And so slowly, yes. What I love about Susie is that slowly she started including emotions through humor, through more personal accounts, in her scientific presentations. And that's what's fantastic about her, is she really is a synthesis of the rational mind and the emotional mind.
There's a little bit in your film where you're filming her. You must be, can't see you, but you must be filming her, and she turns around and she said, "Don't miss that sky." And she just says, "Don't miss that sky." And then we see a bird. And I thought, that's good, because she seems to be able to live in the moment as well. Don't miss this moment, because that's what I feel with all this climate change, which I've been doing for 10 or 11 years now, like this radio. I in fact enjoy life more. It's so precious. Every single thing is so precious because it's normal, you know, normal weather, normal climate, you know, spring in the right, at the right time of year. I'm delighted by it. But she had that thing too. Look, don't miss the sky. And I think you caught quite a few things in your film like that. Listen, now, what led you to Extinction Rebellion? I wonder, do you see some strategy behind their protests?
Well, first, what I must say is that I've never identified as an activist. I was very concerned, but you can have different kinds of emotions when when it comes to climate change or the future, or how you project into the future. And fear is one. Leads to paralysis. Sadness is another one. Anger is another one. And anger is often the energy that's driving activism. You know, anger because there is a sense of injustice. Injustice is a very strong driver of Salim, one of the characters in the film. And what was powerful for me is that there was a real intersection or going back and forth between my real life and the film. And the film had a very powerful influence on my own life. So it led me to do things that I had no idea were going to happen. I was just filming my life, and I started doing things that because I was meeting Salim and saying, okay, you know, he's been at every single CUP conference since the beginning, and he is relentless. And this is what needs to happen. This is what we need to do. This is the kinds of courage we need. And then as I was working on these questions of, you know, bringing emotion and the rational mind together and how that spurs you into action, the Extinction Rebellion came into being, and it became part of the story just very naturally. So I joined the French branch of the movement, and I became very involved. I'm still very involved. And what happened was that the opening, the beginning, what's called the Declaration of Rebellion, which is the official beginning of activities of a branch in the country, became sort of the ending of the film, the last sequence. So it's kind of like a promise. You don't know what's going to happen to this movement, whether it will grow bigger and become a mass movement or not. And so that's where we come to strategy. And I think that you really need to listen to what people are going through. And this was actually the message that many years earlier, Susie had already for me. She said, you know, stop asking, because she's also working a lot on climate change communication. Stop talking to people, asking them what they think about climate change, because all you're going to get is debate. You need to ask them how they feel about it. And this is where you can find a place to connect. And I think this is what I find interesting with Extinction Rebellion as a movement, is that they have a whole aspect which is called regenerative culture, which is about taking care of each other before action, in action, after action, but also more generally listening to that more emotional or intuitive side of us, and not shying away from it because, this is the irrational mind, so it's a dangerous place, we shouldn't go there. We think it's part of the human psyche, and it needs to be heard.
Many people think that we'll manage the climate disruption like we've managed the pandemic. You know, it's been terrible, but we've sort of managed it. But people in your film say we must prepare for much worse than that, like crop failures, like the bees collapsing, that sort of thing. How should we prepare?
How should we prepare? I think it depends who we is. We as individuals in rich countries, we in Bangladesh is not the same we. We are all on the same boat, but the boat definitely has different levels, and there are different classes. And I would say there is not two, but probably three or four different classes. And people at the bottom of the ship, what they need to do and what they are already doing is pressing with both hands on the hull so that the water stops pouring in, because they are already drowning. There are already people who are being, you know, losing their lives and being pushed out of their territories, their lands, by climate change. So what they need to be doing is to keep fighting like they already are, and also seek climate justice, I think. What we need to be doing in the rich world, and that world is also quite unequal, and so I think that also asks questions of equality within countries, within nations. But what I think we need to do is to face the fact that we need to have national and international conversations. And I think the pandemic has made that possible, because before it was too far remote. But now I think it is possible, about what would be a collapse politics. And what collapse politics is not asking whether or not we want things to things like degrowth and things like reduced buying power or reduced consumption, reduced freedom of movement, but how we're going to deal with them on a collective level so that they happen as smoothly as possible. So it's not how do we want it or not, but how do we manage it? Because it's going to happen whether or not we want it.
Yeah.
And one of the characters in the film, Jean-Marc Jancovici, who is very straight-faced and asks very difficult questions, very hard questions, says, this is what's called l'optimisation sous contrainte, optimizing under constraint. And this is what it's about. And what that means is we're not going to be able to hold on to everything that we've come to take for granted. And we are going to have to lose some things. And I think it's very important we choose which things to leave behind and which things to keep with us, because some things are essential to keep with us. If we want to have a social contract where people want to continue living as societies and continue accepting some things from their neighbors and from their fellow citizens, because they feel that they are being connected by something that is meaningful, even though everything they used to take or part of what they used to take for granted is being taken away from them. I think this is what we need to do.
Yeah. I like the idea of optimization under constraints, because we know that. We've been through that. Most of our civilizations have been through terrible deprivation, the depression, the war, in living memory of people. And it's often their finest hour. We mythologize it as the finest hour. We certainly know how to do it. That's why I don't like those dystopian films that make out that everybody's greedy and selfish and ready to kill each other and cunning. I mean, that's not my experience of life. It's not, you know, many people talk about how they understand the common good. When there's a crisis in Australia, we have plenty of bushfires and floods. We see magnificent response. So I feel that climate change should bring out the best in us. It could, but as you say, it needs to be planned, and therefore you need to have that discussion. That's why I love it that you've made this film, and the more you talk about it. We don't talk about that at all in Australia. I haven't heard anyone in the media talking like that about it, making a plan.
Because we're not back against the wall yet. We're not back against the wall
exactly
yet.
Exactly. No, that's right.
Hi, I'm David Bradbury, activist filmmaker, and proud of it. And anytime I'm in Melbourne, I love to do an interview with 3CR and bring you folk up to speed with what I'm doing in different parts of the globe or in my own turf in Australia. It's really important that we have community radio and that you support it and you get out behind 3CR and the events that they promote, and to keep you informed against the mainstream media that wants us to keep our eyes shut and to go back to bed.
One of the things that you show in your film is transition towns, and they are exploring new ways of cooperating. And I think they're kind of under the radar. They're not protesters. They're quietly doing something new, probably something quite old as well. And I wonder, is this a form of climate action for you? And does it bring out the best in people?
Joanna Macy brought it very simply. She said, we need to have a thriving world or a more sustainable world. We need three pillars of action. And one is holding actions that draw red lines and say, we will not go beyond these boundaries. And these are, you know, activism and protest and being against something that needs to stop destruction of ecosystem services or destruction of a stable climate that makes everything else possible. And then we also need a change of consciousness. We need education, you know, the kind of work you're doing, and we need a new narrative and giving meaning to all these changes of this great turning we're in. And then the third part of the work, which is the one you just mentioned, is alternatives, offering different ways of doing things, changing systems, whether they're food systems, communication systems, transportation systems. This is really what I try to do in the film. We see the change of consciousness of one character, which is me. We also need, I have my son coming with his radio. His own little portable radio. And I hope it's not disturbing the recording. Constructing alternatives is not sexy. It takes a long time. It's about working with your neighbors on a very long-term basis. Change is very incremental. In the village where I live, called Sayan, which is at the foot of the Alp Mountains, we are really trying to work on how do we reinvent today or reinvent tomorrow while we still have to deal with today. And, you know, I think that's really interesting. It's just confronting reality. So we've had a participatory democracy platform from which to take decisions throughout the 6-year mandate. And that really has changed the dynamics in the village. I think this village experiment around democracy is really central to what we were talking about earlier, this conversation of what are we going to keep and what do we need to leave behind.
I know this because I interview a lot of the school strikers, and I interviewed one of them this morning, and she said, well, we can't vote, and so we have to find other ways to get our voice out, and it's our future that's being decided by the people in Parliament. They're all mostly old, much older, and white, and men. And, you know, now we have people of colour and much more women leading, and it doesn't represent us. So I was really impressed by the French Citizens Assembly. I did a few interviews with people about that, and they went through such a long process. It wasn't 30 years. It was 9 months, but it was like a real gestation. It was like a pregnancy, 9 months of learning every expert they could find. And the person I interviewed saw it as different from becoming activists. She said some of us have entered politics after too and become mayors or local government. But she said she feels the result has been good because some people who went in they're not going to sacrifice anything. That was their first attitude. When they came out, they were saying things like, no, I'm prepared to take a cut in my living. I understand now what it's for this common good. And she said, and if we send a email, for example, to President Macron, he writes straight back. So we have the ear of the government. We feel that we're citizens with some platform. And I wondered, did you find other examples like that around the world or in your village or in France? It seems to be much more advanced than here.
Examples we found to inspire ourselves were from other parts of the world, in the US. I think you can find this tradition of citizen participation in different kinds of contexts. In the US, you have, you know, the duty being part of the jury. I'm not sure in Australia if you have that as well, that you've been called to be. So I think we need to have exactly that for many other things.
Yes.
That you are being called upon, not just to go to war or to judge people, but to, make hard decisions.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get out of the duty of taking that decision for everyone. But maybe not at the national level because not everybody can take that decision. So what I'm working on right now in France with Extinction Rebellion and other movements, the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Jackets, our local Yellow Jacket or Yellow Vests groups and us are trying to work together to bring the social and the environmental together on bringing that CCC, the Climate Citizen Convention, that you were mentioning earlier, to bring it down to the local level and say, okay, so they've made these 150 recommendations to the government at the national level. Some of those recommendations are not being heard because the government thinks we're not courageous enough as a nation to make those changes. Well, we're going to show the government at the local level that we are willing to talk about these changes and actually talk about the very concrete things we need to put in place at the local level to make that a reality. And of course, it's a rhetorical exercise. We're not that assembly we're putting together doesn't have any power. People are ready to bring it down to earth and bring it down to when it's going to hit them, you know, hit their pocket, hit their way of lifestyle.
What specifically are they doing or are you doing?
We really wanted it to be relevant to the people locally. So I'm in a very rural area where you have a lot of, agriculture. So we wanted to talk about some of the agricultural recommendations as to, you know, land use changes, as well as what the relationship to between agriculture and the general public, what kind of food we buy, where do we buy it, what we call the circuit court. Circuit court are kind of like producer to consumer direct buying. And all these kinds of things that we need to put in place everywhere to shorten the length that food travels, to bring down their emissions levels, but also bring down what we have a huge problem in France, but it's like this everywhere, which is called artificialisation des sols. It's the fact that it's land use changes. We're turning good fertile ground into concrete, and we're making it dead. And that is a huge problem. And every 7 years, we have a whole region of France that's being the equivalent of one region of France that's being covered in concrete or asphalt or roads or parking lots. And that is a huge problem, because as long as you have fossil fuels and you can produce a lot of food on a little land, yeah, then you're fine. When you start to have to produce for that, the very large population we have become in the world,
yeah,
and you don't have fossil fuels, you need that land.
Oh, wow. Well, I hope you can report back to us another time when you've developed that a bit more in your place. I want to just finish on something lovely that we did once. Our most popular podcast, I was surprised. It was about Albert Camus. It was about the plague. Well, it was in the COVID crisis, and what he saw in a place called Le Chambon. And I had a philosopher who was an expert on the Holocaust, and he talked about the people of Le Chambon who smuggled Jewish people out of Le Chambon into Switzerland. And they did it in a very strategic way. They were committed to each other. They just trusted each other. They passed messages to each other. They didn't have any official organization, just the church. The minister at the church sort of coordinated them, but they managed to smuggle out a great number of people. And he said, it was very exceptional in Europe what they did, but for them it was normal because they were people who were just, that was part of their religion, it was part of their ideology that that's what you must do, you must save refugees. And they did it. And apparently Le Chambon is still quite famous as a place for refugees. So I love that story when we did it, but I was surprised that it was the most popular podcast because it was really philosophical and quite long. But that's the one everyone wanted to hear. And I asked some people, and they said, we want to know how people prepare for the worst. And so I think that's why your film is so interesting, that you are actually trying to help people prepare for the worst. So could you finish by just speaking to us about that, about what you've learned about this emphasizing the cooperative and the good and the, you know, how we can quickly learn what we need to learn to survive?
Mm. Big questions.
I know.
I think we need to first make a difference between an emergency and the long emergency. An emergency is Hurricane Katrina, is the fires in Australia last year. Contrary to what the media often show, as you said earlier, the very, very dominant response is solidarity, people helping each other, people bringing food to each other, saving each other, and not rioting and looting. This is a part of the story, absolutely, but it's a very minor part of the story. Because in this kind of context, we are still operating in a mindset that is abundant. We have abundance of goods around us, and suddenly it's being taken away from us, and so we want to share from that abundance. Okay, still, I have some leftover foods and I want to share. So, and there is a very high level of trust more generally in the culture, even though we can feel it's, you know, we've become more individualistic. We have a very high level of confidence and trust. We feel that we can walk in the streets and we're not going to get killed by our neighbor and this kind of security, general security that we have the chance to experience in our countries. In the long emergency, and so this kind of response is it's a reality, and can definitely work off of that and use that to say, okay, this is what we want. We want to help each other as much as we can. This is where our tendency is. So that's very hopeful and exciting, and it's something to work off of. But in the long emergency, and we're experiencing exactly that in France right now, and I think in other countries with, you know, second waves of the COVID and confinement, is the kind of excitement and bringing, you know, pulling together that happened in the first wave, we're not seeing as much of in the second wave, because people grow wary and, you know, what was on their minds, you know, other people and how they're, you know, who are in the streets, you know, the homeless were in the streets, were being exposed to COVID and going out and giving them food. All of that brings meaning in an emergency. But as the emergency draws longer, it becomes harder and harder to create meaning, because there is no horizon. There is no long-term vision. And so I think really that I think that's the message I have with the film. I try to say it not with my big boots, and, you know, I try to say it throughout the film, it's everywhere, is we need to have a vision, because otherwise chaos is going to take care of it for us. And that vision is something that is positive, even though it is quite different from what we have grown used to. And I'll try to summarize it in a sentence. It's scary, but I think it's hopeful. Right now, we have two very different kinds of discourses. We have a social discourse, at least in France, and I think maybe to some extent in countries like Australia, is one discourse, which is that we are seeing increasing levels of inequality, and it's quite unfair, and it's really actually tearing at our social fabric, and we need to be very careful, because high levels of inequality are going to kill the trust that's necessary to make a society stable and vibrant. So they say, oh, we have a huge economic cake, and we just need to have it better shared. That's one discourse. And the other discourse, which we will call the environmental discourse, is no. The problem is not that it's not well shared, or at least that's not our main problem. The main problem is that this economic cake is too big. We need to bring down the cake. And so those are very different discourses. And someone on a Facebook chat actually had a fantastic sentence that I feel has the capacity to bring these two visions together. And he said, just one little sentence, crumbs are right, but crumbs for everyone. And what that means is, as the economic cake is going to be reduced in size, not because we are willing to do it, because we're going to put in place all the necessary measures to dwarf the climate crisis, but just because we have energy depletion that's going to do it for us, probably, unfortunately, we are going to have to also think about how do we share what's left. Mm-hmm. And if we're able to do that, then I think we are in for a very different kind of society in the future, and a hopeful society where we actually reach some of the ideals and goals that we had earlier, which we were able to earlier in history, but with some of the great ideologies, social ideologies of the 20th century, but which we pushed off because we said, as long as we have abundance, everybody can just do what they want, and the trickle down effect will take care of it. You know, we'll be able to, even the poor will have, as the tide rise, all the boats rise with the tide, and we'll be able to take care of equality that way. And I think, unfortunately, we're not going to have that mechanism for us in a degrowth imposed world.
So we've been speaking to film director Emmanuel Caplin in France, and his film, Once You Know, is a marvelous thing not to be missed at the Transitions Film Festival. Just to finish, Emmanuel, would you like to tell us if you're going to do part two to this film, or if you, you know, want to continue with this story, where would you take it?
A few months ago, when people asked me this question, I would say, no way, I am done. You know, I've spent 8 years on this film. I've lost so much in the process. I've gained a lot as well. I'm tired. I'm going to rest for the next 10 years. Now, actually, once you put your finger in the machine, you know, it's very hard to stop. And not the machine of documentary filmmaking only, but also of the issues we've been talking about, because they're so existential. And what I'm interested in at the moment, and I'm not sure what form it's going to take formally, I don't know if it's going to be a documentary, I think so, is the question we spoke earlier of the climate politics and the collapse politics of tomorrow. There's a number of people who are working on these issues very seriously, but they're hidden in offices somewhere in universities. You don't see them. But we have people who are very seriously working on how do you reconstruct the social contract that binds us all together so that you have social stability in an unstable world. And I'm very interested with those new ideas and how politics will evolve once we're past the time of abundance.
That's fantastic. Thank you. I think that's very valuable. And as you said, we need a vision. We need a blueprint. You know, people need to know where we're going. If there's something like that ahead, and then, as you said, we need to know what we need to save on the way down. So thank you very much for talking to us. It's been very nice to meet you, Emmanuel Caplin.
This is a message of solidarity for all the women out there from Think Again on 3CR. For all the women who still, after all this time, are underpaid and undervalued, who carry most of the burden of caring work, who live precariously and carry all the risk while others walk off with the gold. This is a message of solidarity for you, because you are the true gold. You are not the loot to plunder by self-entitled, born-to-rulers. So always know your value and remember, together we are strong.
Here's a song from David Rovix. It's called If There's a Tomorrow.
The death toll keeps mounting each time I turn on my phone. Another mass shooting, another free fire zone. The failed states of America, white supremacist rule, a society riven with victims and tools. The fires keep burning, completely out of control. Makes you miss the old days of the ozone hole. The snow is all melting, the lakes of Greenland. The best hope that I have, I hold in my hand. If there's a tomorrow, then when yesterday's through, you have me, and I have you. We might have to leave town, or maybe we'll fall beneath a hail of bullets at the shopping mall. Perhaps we'll be arrested, perhaps they'll pass us by. But wherever we might be, when we look up at the sky, if there's a tomorrow, then when yesterday's through, you have me, and I have you. We'd like it to be different, but this is the place we find. The one we inherit, the one we're in now. Whatever might come of the future, why, when, how? If there's a tomorrow, then when yesterday's through, you have me, and I have you. If there's a tomorrow, then when yesterday's through, you have me.
This show was first broadcast in 2021.
Welcome, Nathan. Tell us what it's like where you are right now.
Sure. It is just coming out of a big cold snap. I'm in Boulder, Colorado, and we have quite a lot of snow predicted for this evening and tomorrow. So that's where we are at the moment.
Nathan's film is about an old-style carpet factory called Interface and its founder, Ray Anderson. And listeners might remember Paul Hawkins spoke to us when he published his book Drawdown. And this is Paul Hawkins' comment on Interface. He said, when it was an old factory, he said it sucked up petroleum-based raw materials for breakfast, lunch and dinner. Its finished product lasted little more than a decade, and at that point it will be ripped out and discarded, joining 5 billion pounds of carpet each year in landfill, where it would remain for 10,000 years. Now, Anderson read Hawkins' book called Ecology of Commerce, and apparently his thinking evolved. Nathan, tell us what happened next when the owner realized he needed to take some climate action.
Sure. Just a piece of color on this. At the time, before Ray read Paul's book, there was a sales boast that they would make that you could take a piece of Interface carpet, you could put it in a pile of compost and leave it there for a few seasons and take it out again, and nothing would have happened to it. That was a sales boast, right? And so Ray reads Paul's book, and what happened was what Ray came to call his spear in the chest moment, where he was an engineer by training, and his engineer's brain just sort of accepted the case that Paul Hawken makes in that book, which is that, you know, all of Earth's major life support systems are in decline, and that the chief culprit for that is industry. And Ray is, as a captain of industry, the founder that created this company, he stood there indicted. He said his quote is, I stood indicted as a plunderer of the earth. And so the reason he read the book was because he was asked to make an environmental vision speech for a brand new environmental task force at Interface. And he read this book and came up with this incredible environmental vision. You know, he was sweating it before that, no idea what to do, but he, you know, people walked into that meeting expecting a little recycling, but what Ray laid out is essentially a complete transformation of the industrial economy as we know it. And so here he comes, and that's how it began.
Yeah, well, that actually started quite a long time ago, and I think you said that this story sort of got lost. It should be such a beacon for everybody, but it's more or less not common knowledge, not in Australia anyway. And I wondered, how did this company get to zero fossil fuel energy, zero greenhouse gas emissions, and zero waste to landfill?
Over 25 years of very meticulous work, engaging their employees, engaging their supply base. One of the major innovations for them was in nylon. And nylon is a material that is as energy intensive to produce as aluminum is. When they started this journey, nylon was the fiber that they used in all of their carpet. And the scientists at the time said it's impossible to recycle nylon. And any recycled material would be seen as a contaminant in the process. And so for a decade, they worked with their suppliers saying, if somebody can hack this one, you will get all of our purchasing. You know, and it's a big company, but it's not a big company by big company standards. So they were able to lean a little bit on the market pressure there, but it's not like it's not like some of the really big companies. But there's an Italian company named Aquafil that ended up being able to crack that nut. And Aquafil now can create 100% recycled nylon, which was the major piece for Interface to be able to close the loop and actually harvest old carpet off of people's floors instead of harvesting new petroleum to make new nylon. Right. And so that helped them to close the loop. And that right there is just this massive piece of the technological innovation that they had to figure out to be able to make that progress. Now, I think that it's fair to say that Interface is within the margin of error on zero. I don't think that they are at zero yet. But when you consider the influence that they've had, you know, that fiber that Aquafil developed for them is now being used by Prada and Gucci and all kinds of other things. And it's really Interface that gets a lot of the credit for getting Aquafil to focus and make that innovation. So if you factor in the influence they've had on other manufacturers, then they're well beyond zero.
You mentioned recycling. I mean, the model for this company is that they're floor tiles, aren't they? Carpet tiles.
That's right.
And you buy them, and when they're worn out in your office, what happens?
First of all, tiles as opposed to broadloom, right? So in 1973, when the company was founded, it was all broadloom carpet. And so if there was a coffee spill or there was a if anything happened to it, you'd eventually have to rip out the entire broadloom carpet and replace the whole thing. So from the get-go, having a tile kind of a thing to rip out a single tile that had been soiled or worn and replace that with a new tile, that's already better from a waste standpoint, right? But today, when you rip out a tile, there is a collection plan that Interface has where you can literally send it back into Interface. They will grind it up and then create another new carpet tile out of that very material. So there's no, or very little, I should say, virgin materials used in that process.
Okay. Well, what did you learn when you were making the film about the ripple on effect to other businesses? You already told about the Italian nylon company, but what other companies? There was one in Georgia with the gas. They stopped using gas and started using landfill gas. But what other ones did you find?
Yeah, there are dozens. And what's been really interesting about it, and really part of the reason that I wanted to make the film, is that when people hear this story, for some reason, it really has an impact on what they believe is possible and on what they believe the game of business is all about. Right. And so Ray Anderson had this epiphany, and then it became a calling for him, and it became a higher purpose for the company. And as Ray went around telling this story, his spear in the chest moment became a spear in the chest moment for literally countless other business people. Some notable examples would be Lee Scott, who at the time was the CEO of Walmart. Richard Branson is a great fan of this story. Paul Pullman, who is the former CEO of Unilever. And on and on. There's one of the producers of the film is a gentleman named Bill Hayward, who's the CEO of Hayward Lumber. And after meeting Ray, he went and started a process that eventually led to that FSC certified lumber. Bill and his company were instrumental in the early years of making that a known thing in the market. And so Ray would just give a speech, and there are so many people that I've met since making the movie that tell me the story of the day they met Ray Anderson and what they did in their business after that. And as you said, this story was much better known in the late 90s. But it kind of, after I don't know what happened, but it's just, it there's so many people that are into sustainable business. They're into conscious capitalism. They should know the story cold, and they've never heard of it. And so that's part of the impetus here, is to make sure that the business world now, especially the aspiring business leaders that are coming up through the ranks now, know this story very well, because I think it's very instructive.
Right. Well, look, large claims are made in your film about transforming the world economy, about reimagining capitalism and stakeholder capitalism, which I hadn't heard that term before. But I thought unregulated capitalism was really the problem. I'm sure it is. Wouldn't most corporations be bankrupt if they paid the environmental damage they do?
Yes, they would be. And I think that one of the major problems of capitalism is this myopic focus on financial capital. And that is inherently unsustainable. And if capitalism continues down that road, the consequences are dire. And that's an understatement, right? So the way forward, the reason this story matters, I think, is that it proves the point that even a global, dirty, publicly traded company, right, which Interface was in 1994, even that company can, through some very intentional action, become a paragon of not just sustainability, but regeneration. Because right now, and this is, Paul Hawken, when we interviewed him for the film, he talks about sustainability isn't enough. We've only got about a decade, and we're just not going to make it unless there are companies like Interface that can sequester carbon actively through their activities and buy us more time. And so that's the imperative of the modern moment here. And Interface is the case that you can do that and still have a viable financial model that returns a fair value to investors, that you can win at the game of business without sacrificing the game of sustainability. And that is the imperative of this moment. And so for capitalism even for capitalism to continue to exist, like, never mind the social pressures that are putting pressure on capitalism, but capitalism is built on the free services that nature provides. And if those services erode, there will be no capitalism. there will be no business, right? There may not be humanity. And supposedly this decade is the decade where we're going to choose which of those paths we go down, right? So there are amazing models of people that have figured out ways that you can measure financial capital and natural capital and social capital and get all of that onto your balance sheet. And the way that you manage a company when you're looking at all of that actually is more resilient. And in many cases, it is even more profitable than just focusing on financial capital alone. And we've got to get that message out. And again, the Interface story is just a fantastic proof point of it. Not only is it's the Jay Gould quote at the end of the film, right? If Interface can do it, anyone can do it. And if anyone can do it, everyone should do it.
Right. Well, look, it's a pretty exciting moment in the United States regarding your new president. And he has said he's taking climate action seriously. And I wonder, could you just fill us in? What's the latest? What are you observing, you know, in things that are actually happening on the ground? I think he said he's going to do it very fast.
And thank you. And it's all happening so fast that I don't know that I've got the most up to date take on it. But in relief to his predecessor, it is a stark difference in terms of, I guess the big thing for me is that it feels like this administration is not really willing to engage in the debate about the validity of climate science or whether this is a thing or not. It is sort of, we're going to start with this is if not the major crisis that faces the world today. It is our generation's duty to treat it thusly, because if we don't, the next generation may not have the opportunity to do something about it.
But what have you noticed that he's doing? What things stick out? Because he's been making declarations hard and fast.
Yeah, I mean, just getting back into Paris on day one is a huge step in the right direction. And I think that I guess for me, and where you might be getting to here, Vivian, is that there is, I think, a kind of two-pronged approach here that needs to happen between government regulation, which is essential to make sure that the laggards in this conversation don't sink the whole game, right?
Yeah.
And really embracing some of the innovative business strategies that there are, you know, pioneering companies that are kind of figuring out how to do this. And politics is the art of the possible. Unfortunately, in the United States and in many places around the world, there's such a campaign of disinformation on this topic that it makes this politically much more difficult than it maybe should be or could be, which is why, again, stories like Interface, where there was no regulation that had Interface do what it was. There was no special government incentive. So I think that there's a little bit of a double-edged sword where you need to really embrace the innovators that are going to do this, because it's smart business, right? As Ray Anderson's other great quote, so right, so smart.
3CR, here to stay.
Well, in your history, I really like Franklin Delano Roosevelt's story. And in the middle or the beginning of the Second World War, when America was still holding back and then they got involved, and in a lot of history accounts of him calling in the captains of industry and telling them to turn it around. The phrase is they turned it around on a dime. Everybody knows that there was a great social improvement because of that. There are a lot of jobs created, a lot of the racism was sort of sidelined because of that urgency to fight the war and equal jobs for women in heavy industry and so on. And I just imagine if this was going to happen now and they called in companies like Interface, how would that fit in, like a Green New Deal we're talking about? Naomi Klein talks about that all the time, and she talks about the caring economy. What sort of social impact has Interface already had? Do you think it would have if it was in such a meeting?
First of all, as I'm sure you're well aware, there is a Green New Deal proposal that's before the U.S. Congress. I think that is a massive opportunity, just a massive opportunity for that to happen. And I think that for Interface, the lessons that are between the lines in the Interface story are a little bit more nuanced. And this is, again, you sort of gave me this in terms of kind of looking at a caring economy, that I'm not sure that you can have a sustainable economy from an environmental standpoint, you know, strict PPM on carbon and greenhouse gas equivalents. I don't know that you can do that absent a caring economy. I think that, you know, Paul Hawken, in his interview, he also was kind of talking about this is inherently linked with social justice and economic justice on a global scale. And so when we were making the film, I had fully intended to have some sort of complimentary corporate training or something. And so when the film was done, I had a chance to talk with Erin Mizan at Interface about what's needed. And she said, well, what's not needed is anything else that's a specific program around sustainability measuring, or there's phenomenal work that's being done in that space. And so there's no need there, but where there's a need is empowering these intrapreneurs to be able to lead these change efforts within their companies. And you know, for a lot of the companies that Erin has advised, that's where it breaks down, is you have these people that are trying to do these efforts, but they just can't seem to get it through the hierarchy. And Leif has done it extremely effectively at Harvard. She's studied this for years now, and she's just got an incredible body of work on this.
We're talking to Nathan Havey, and he's made this film called Beyond Zero. Now, one of the spin-offs from the Beyond Zero film is that I think you're offering a professional development course, and the film is one part of it. What models will you teach about going beyond zero?
The course that we've created is called the Intrapreneur Accelerator. And it's a year-long experiential course that's a bit of a mouthful, but you study Leif Sharp's materials in terms of entrepreneurship, and then you look at what we consider to be the six essential elements for corporate transformation. Getting to this beyond zero regenerative place in your environmental impacts is one of six. Briefly, the others are making sure that your financial model is sufficient so that everybody throughout the value chain for the business is able to be sufficient, right? They have enough to meet their basic needs at least. And you do that before anybody concentrates wealth and gets rich, which is not at all the financial model of most companies, right? So those two things, you have to have a culture that helps people to be cared for and grow into their best selves. You have to engage your entire stakeholder ecosystem to sort of co-create even your business so that it's not take it or leave it or cut 5% off of that or we're going somewhere else. It's really co-creating that space. Companies have a great role to play in deliberately dismantling systems of discrimination that exist in all of our countries. There's this idea that you could do all of that and still think that the purpose of your company is to maximize profit. No, there has to be a purpose beyond profit. Profit is what fuels the purpose, not the other way around. And so companies getting that right is a critical piece of this. And so entrepreneurship, those six distinctions, and then a six-month pilot project that they author and run within their company, supported by the network, getting your company to be part of a network of sorts. There is one through the Biomimicry Institute that's called Project Positive, which is a group of companies that are all working to get past zero to a positive environmental benefit. And so as far as a roadmap, you're not going to do that in a year. It might take 6 or 7. But these are the 6 or 7 years that companies must be on that journey if we're going to do what we need to do as a generation.
All right. Thank you, Nathan. Thank you for giving us your time and thank you for making your film. I hope listeners will watch that film and maybe join your, what, say it again, the name of the accelerator?
Sure. The Intrapreneur Accelerator. And that's tough to remember. So if folks need more information, they can go to beyondzerofilm.com.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Vivian.
Goongroo Environment Centre is a grassroots community organisation campaigning for East Gippsland's precious forests. For over 15 years, we've been using direct action, citizen science and community engagement to stop the continued logging of precious native forests and threatened species habitat. After this summer's terrible bushfires, there's an even greater urgency to protect what remains, and the Victorian government haven't ruled out plans to log the small fragments of unburnt forests and so-called salvage log in burnt areas. It's now so important that forests and wildlife are protected so they can recover. Head to gecko.org.au to keep updated with the latest news and to get involved. Gecko acknowledges the logging is happening on the stolen lands of the Gunnakernai and Bidwell and the Naro people and that sovereignty was never ceded.
A 3CR supporter.
Thanks tonight to our guests, Emmanuel Capelin and Nathan Havey. Thanks to Daniel Simon from the Transition Film Festival, who helped me get the interviews, and to Michaela and Raoul, who got this show to air.
The music tonight was from a French group called La Bamboche and from David Rovix, and we heard his song, If There's a Tomorrow. My name is Vivian Langford. Good night and good luck.
The show was first broadcast in 2021.